This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Bill Condon, wrote and directed the film Kinsey, based on the life of Alfred Kinsey, who conducted groundbreaking research into human sexuality. The film has recently come out on DVD. In the 40s, Kinsey was a biology professor who studied the gall wasp and found that no two wasps were the same. Each was unique. He decided to expand his research to humans, specifically to the scientific study of human sexuality, a subject that was considered taboo. His 1948 book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, was based on thousands of interviews with people about the most intimate parts of their lives. He followed that up with a book about female sexuality. His work was enormously controversial in its time and remains so among those people who believe he opened the door to sexual amorality. Here's a scene from Kinsey, after Alfred Kinsey has decided to investigate human sexuality and teach a course on marriage. He's in the classroom. Kinsey is played by Liam Neeson.
Why offer a marriage course? Because society has interfered with what should be a normal biological development, causing a scandalous delay of sexual activity, which leads to sexual difficulty in early marriage. In an uninhibited society, a 12-year-old would know most of the biology, which I will have to give you in formal lectures. So, let's start with the 6 stages of the coital sequence. Both sexes experience all 6 stages equally. Stimulation. Who can tell me which part of the human body can enlarge 100 times? Miss.
I'm sure I don't know. And you've no right to ask me such a question in a mixed class.
I was referring to the pupil of your eye, young lady. And I think I should tell you, you're in for a terrible disappointment.
Terry Gross spoke with Bill Condon last year. A warning to parents, you might not find this interview appropriate for children. Terry asked Condon how Kinsey got people to respond candidly to his questionnaire about their sexual history when they would be unlikely to feel comfortable discussing such an intimate subject with friends or spouses.
One of the most original things about the methodology was that he always assumed you had done everything. So it was never, have you ever, you know, masturbated. It was, when was the first time you masturbated? With every question, the burden of kind of admission was taken off of you. It was just assumed you had done it all. So there was an extremely non-judgmental approach. He also had these ways of bringing the questions back to the same place over and over again, and really being able to test whether your answers were consistent. You know, so he worked in a lot of tripwires to weed out the liars and the exaggerators, which of course is one of the real problems with taking sex histories. In general, having collected these 8 million gall wasps, he was trying to apply the same idea to sex. If I can just get more than anybody else, his aim was to get 100,000. He actually wound up getting about 28,000, but that's still more than anybody had or has since then.
Do you think that even though he got thousands and thousands of people to respond to his survey, do you think that they were a representative sample of either Americans or of people in general in their approaches to sex?
Well, it's interesting. I think, first of all, it's nothing more than a snapshot of the country at the time, you know, so that the male volume really represents men during World War II,
mm-hmm.
And the female that and a little later. He'd solved one of the big challenges facing sex researchers, but in doing so created another problem. You know, the challenge was inevitably somebody who's going to talk to you about his or her sex life is probably more sexually comfortable and active than people who won't. So therefore, the data might already be skewed in a certain direction. He came up with this idea with the help actually of Ray Kroc's brother, the founder of McDonald's, that they would get 100% groups. They would get people who'd gotten together for a reason that had nothing to do with sex, a bowling league or a lady sewing circle, and get 100% of those people to give their sex histories, actually using tactics that, you know, no one could get away with today. You know, the first 40 or 50% would fall in pretty easily. Then he'd use them to convince, you know, the next 20 or 30%. And the holdouts really were subjected to threats. They were no longer going to be in the bowling league or the sewing circle and late night phone calls until finally everybody agreed to do it. So
talk about peer pressure.
Exactly. So he felt, if I just get enough of these groups, then it has to all add up to a kind of representative sample of America. And of course, that wasn't true. You know, he oversampled in certain groups. He, you know, too many inmate histories, for example. Something that he corrected in the female volume. Everybody always raises this issue of 10% of males being homosexual, you know, and Kinsey actually never said that. Kinsey actually thought, again, for him, homosexual was an adjective describing acts. He thought on the sixth end of his scale, people who were involved in exclusively homosexual acts, that was anywhere from 2 to 4% of the population, which basically falls in line with what people think today. What he did say was that 10% of the population had exclusively homosexual activity for 3 years in their adulthood. Now, you have to remember, again, snapshot of a time and a place. This is America during wartime, A, and B, at a time when most schools were single sex. So these are things that wouldn't apply today. But that's an example of something where a strict look at his data comes up with basically the same result as what people come up with today.
One of the questions that you have him asking in the movie, a question I really like that isn't directly related to sex, is this: how young were you when you no longer
Yes.
thought of your parents' home as your own? And there's two things I really like about that question. One is that it doesn't say how old were you, it says
Yes.
how young were you.
Yeah.
And the other is that, like, what a really interesting question to ask. Like, at what point did you realize this is no longer what you're about, or the
Exactly.
center of your life? You've moved on to becoming an adult person, a differentiated person.
I know. I love that question, too. And it was obviously, sort of a real find for, you know, when I was writing the script, because it allows you to sort of deal with so much in the context of sexuality. And that's what he would do. He would ease in with these biographical questions and then slowly start to expand so that you got a question like that isn't directly about sex, but in some basic way is, because mm-hmm. obviously that differentiation does happen during adolescence, during the onset of adolescence.
Now you interviewed one of Kinsey's researchers as background
Yes.
for the screenplay. What are some of the things, like, which researcher was it, and what were some of the things Yeah. you learned either about the researcher or about Kinsey's own life?
It was Paul Gebhardt, the character played by Tim Hutton in the movie. You know, the thing that struck me more than anything about him was the absolute sense of openness and the non-judgmental nature of talking to him. Here I was in this sort of awkward position of interviewing the ultimate interviewer and having to ask, you know, pretty jump in and ask some pretty, you know, intimate questions. What was sex night like at the Kinseys, for example? You know, and he was so matter of fact about it all, about the affair that he'd had with one of the other researchers' wives when he first arrived in Bloomington, the effect that had on his marriage. It was, again, so open that I really got a glimpse into how these guys pulled it off, you know.
What is sex night at the Kinseys?
Well, you know, they did, it wasn't that frequent, but they did get into Kinsey, you know, did start to promote this idea of open marriages. And Kinsey, somebody who fell into this study, you know, started talking to people about sex, traveling the country talking to them about it, then started observing it, then started filming it, and then finally sort of, you know, went into this to this further point of kind of trying to actually create this sexual, I wouldn't call it utopia, but a certain sexual environment where everything would be open, you know, kind of a swinger way before his time, you know.
This is one of the things that a lot of people find very troubling about his life, because, you
correct.
Know, he's not exactly like the dispassionate scientist just observing behavior under the microscope. He's trying out a lot of things himself, a lot of things that were perceived as definitely violating, you know, the moral code of the time.
That's correct. And I think that's the trouble I think people get into, you know, they very quickly then say that the work was agenda-driven, for example. And there's I really have found no proof for that idea. His first passion was science. You know, the idea of having collected these gall wasps and that he could collect as many human beings was for him more important than anything. Work was more important than anything, you know. But I think, you know, it's a problem that people who work in this area really face, because everyone sort of applies their own kind of code to other people's behavior. So especially when they hear that he was actually having all this extracurricular activity, there's immediately people leap to the conclusion that that's what the whole point of it was. And there's really that is not the case.
The way you portray him in the movie, he's somebody who is very scientifically interested in sex and becomes very interested in the pursuit of sex himself. But that the way you portray him, he's kind of emotionally tone deaf to the consequences that sex can have. For instance, if you're married and then you have relations with somebody outside of that marriage,
Yes. Your
spouse is likely to be upset. And he's a little uncomprehending about those kinds of emotional consequences. Is that based on research that you did about him?
Absolutely. You know, uncomprehending, impatient, you know, so driven by this work. And again, these are, I think that anyone who's unsympathetic to him will find plenty in this portrait to kind of confirm that point of view. You know, he is a complicated character, you know, a complicated person. And that was absolutely a part of it. The, you know, again, starting with the idea of studying sex scientifically, which meant for him outlets, namely orgasms, and then, you know, stripping away religion and morality and culture from that, and then extending that idea further and further into his own life until it became almost a mission with him, is something that is understandably, you know, upsetting for people. I think you have to kind of have a complicated view of the world to really kind of countenance the whole picture, you know?
There's a scene in the movie in which he basically does a sex survey with his
yes.
own father, and the father explains that as a way to punish him for masturbating and to prevent him from doing it further, this harness was created
yes.
for him so that he could no longer do this.
Right.
And it becomes clear in the movie that this is why, one of the reasons why he became so repressed and intolerant and was so repressive in the way he brought up his son. But although that story was told to Kinsey, it wasn't told to Kinsey by his father. It was somebody else who he was administering the survey to who told him.
That's correct.
That story.
Who was also, yes, who also had a similar kind of repressive traits. So, that is me combining two ideas. Kinsey always wishing he'd taken his father's history and never having had a chance to do it, and speculating about something like that about his father, and then this one subject. For me, it's less about Kinsey than a whole position, you know. But the fact that there was no breakthrough with the father, that is dramatic license. There's no question.
What were the criticisms like when he was actually doing his research in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are certain groups that were came out against him. Obviously, the attacks for the statistical methodology. Also, people like Lionel Trilling, Margaret Mead. You know, Margaret Mead, he's taken all the fun out of sex. Lionel Trilling, where's the love? You know, Gore Vidal today was talking about how he repeated that criticism that Trilling had made to him directly to Kinsey. And he said, but I can't measure love, you know, that's not what I'm about. But I think there was certainly, you know, there were, you know, the Times was never a fan. And there's a certain kind of New York intellectual crowd that never really embraced Kinsey, you know, again, thought there was something limited in the whole enterprise.
Of course, you had to face the question of how to make a movie about somebody who is very explicitly researching sex and yet get a rating that allows
yes.
people to go see the
yeah.
movie. So can you talk a little bit about the standards you set for yourself about what to show and what not to show and why you use those standards?
Sure. You know, the whole issue of the rating was a real challenge. In two ways, I have to say. First of all, I wanted to suggest just how revolutionary Kinsey was. You know, he marched into a classroom in the late 30s. in the context of all these hygiene films and put up a slide of intercourse, of an erect penis and a vagina, you know. I wanted to both be able to show that in an R-rated movie and also to suggest just how shocking that was, you know. And the second problem I approached, you know, with a kind of classic studio style of filmmaking, so that you're in this kind of pretty academic setting and you're deep into the movie and it all feels sort of traditional, and then suddenly the slide is there. And I have been pleased to see it with audiences where the gasp that happens among the students is kind of mirrored in the audience, you know, a little bit of nervous wrestling at least. But when we shot it, I was never really sure. I had to shoot a backup of just a clinical drawing because I was never sure we'd get that past the MPAA. And we sent the movie over to them, and they called after a long day of discussion and said, we're giving you an R for pervasive sexual content, and thank you. We learned a lot. So we were all relieved.
These are more biographical questions about
sure.
you, but I'm wondering, like, did you have sex education when you were in school?
We did, actually. I went to a Jesuit high school, all boys, and I remember Father Duffy teaching us about 69 when I was probably 13. It was in the late 60s, and it was in New York, and we couldn't possibly be, as students, more rebellious than the faculty was at that moment, you know. So it was a very progressive school in that way. As I was saying to Gore Vidal today, the first book I think I read about sex was The Prisoner of Sex by Norman Mailer when I was probably 13. And, you know, he had lots of theories. In fact, Gore reminded me that it was over The Prisoner of Sex that the famous battle on the Dick Cavett show happened with Norman Mailer. But one of them was, of course, my only outlet at the time, which was masturbation, that every orgasm is, you know, that doesn't, you know, isn't implanted without a condom in a woman is another chapter of the great American novel that's just been wasted. I mean, you know, he has very specific ideas about his own fluids, I think. So I can remember, you know, that's, and it's been so interesting to me later on to read about Kinsey, and he talked about, you know, Freud reinventing sin as neurosis, you know. And for me, very early on, the sense of having grown up in a devout Catholic household, you know, there was certainly a sense of sin and shame connected with sex. Then to pick up as the first book to get over that, Norman Mailer, and hear some of this, that left me completely confused.
I really like the casting in the movie, and I think Liam Neeson and Laura Linney are terrific. And just on a more trivial note, in terms of the way the film is done, Laura Linney playing Kinsey's wife is, you portray the character as somebody who isn't spending a whole lot of time thinking about how she looks. You know, her clothes are kind of haphazard and lacking in style. On the other hand, they're not so screamingly lacking in style that we'd be making fun of her. She just looks like the kind of person who isn't aware of style, doesn't really care about it. And I thought it was just exactly right. I don't know if she was that way in real life or not, but I think for the character you're portraying her as being, that she was just perfectly dressed.
Well, thank you. And that's Bruce Van Leyen did the costumes, and Laura Linney, who was so intent on getting that right. And it is how she was. And it's kind of what we wanted to celebrate, you know. Again, in, you know, most movies
she wasn't about a vixen.
Exactly, yes, but that's the point. It's everybody's having sex, you know, and including, you know, in movies, you don't get that sense. It's only the pretty people who are having sex, you know. But in real life, that's not the case. And so it was that, to me, one of my favorite scenes is Laura, Liam shirtless, and Peter shirtless. And before we started shooting, I said, belly's out. You know, everybody had a very ordinary body. And that's what's happening in the world.
Well, Bill Condon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Bill Condon speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His film Kinsey is now out on DVD.